say maybe A is better, and then somebody else would say, no, B is better, or whatever. And you'd be amazed at sometimes which antenna he then will tell you he uses. So not always the higher is the better. It depends on the conditions and where you go and how much of a skip and everything. You know, there's a lot of factors that Mother Nature puts into the mix. Now, as far as flying, let me let it drop. I used to have a fellow used to check in here, K2LEN, Len, a good friend of ours, you know, and he checked in here a number of times. He's a commercial airline pilot. Does get on once in a while. He used to get on HF. Board the jetliner that they carried a Collins transmitter, HF transmitter, similar to the KWM2 that they used aboard that plane that he flew. And he used to say a lot of times that you'd be amazed. He says, I'm at 30,000 feet. He says, I thought I'd have the world at my feet. And he says, I'm hearing probably anything. He says, I'm you know, amazed. He says, and all, and many of the airlines, they tell them that sometimes they have to do long-range HF communication. They have to change altitudes because many times, in the case of emergency, they have to actually change the altitude because you would think the higher the better. It just doesn't work that way. I would flabbergast if they hear that. I would think at 30, 35,000 feet, I could say, that the world would be at your knees, Dick, but at your feet, but it doesn't seem to work that way. Over.
And I've got a couple of guesses as to why. For a guy mounting an antenna on his tower in his backyard on 20 meters, he's talking about a fraction of a wavelength to a couple of wavelengths of altitude is all he can muster within the FAA rules for the tower in his backyard. So therefore, the takeoff angle in that situation, because of ground reflection or the mirror image of the antenna, that dominates. When you start getting up to a number like 20,000 feet of altitude, where now you're 330 wavelengths above the ground, now takeoff angle is not a factor in the same way anymore. And now a brand new factor comes in. Let me explain it to you. If I started off with the antenna a half wavelength off the ground, and I look at the elevation pattern, I've got one very big lobe straight up, and that's it. As I start raising the antenna above the ground, that lobe that's straight up starts breaking into two lobes, one that's tilted forward from straight up, one that's tilted rearward from straight up. Assuming now this is an omnidirectional antenna. In the case of a Yagi, which is facing most of its energy forward, that back lobe starts getting weaker than the forward lobe. But you start developing another lobe that starts moving down, and as you go higher and higher altitude, more and more lobes get created at zenith, and they start moving downward, and they all start moving close together. There's a whole bunch of fingers in space, in elevation, that you've got. I think you've got roughly 330 fingers in space, in elevation, when you're 330 wavelengths above the ground. Now, those individual fingers have got peaks and valleys in between them. And if the ideal takeoff angle from your particular ionospheric state today happens to be in one of the nulls between those two elevation peaks, then you may have trouble talking to that particular guy. Or conversely, if two of those lobes are both bouncing off the ionosphere at two slightly different elevation angles, but they end up at your buddy's backyard, those two lobes, the signal from them, two of them, end up out of phase, and therefore he's got two signals coming in, but they hit each other at nearly equal amplitude, 180 degrees out of phase, and he gets a no. He gets a non-reception. So now, a much more complicated set of rules, let me drop, starts happening as you go to a number like 20,000 foot of altitude, you're 330 wavelengths above the ground. Now, as you go up and down in elevation, all of those fingers in space, and I think there's 300 of them, they're all moving up and down, they're all spacing themselves slightly differently as you go up and down in altitude. It's like a fan that's being opened, if you know what I mean. You know, one of these Spanish-type fans. And as such, you're looking for at least one of those lobes to favor the angle of the ionospheric state today to give you the maximum signal for the particular guy you want to talk to. And if the only way that the signal can bounce off the ionosphere happens to be an elevation angle where there is a null between those two lobes, there is no way you can eliminate that null without changing the altitude of the aircraft. That's part of what I think is happening. But I haven't been there. I haven't done it. You're listening to a bunch of speculation on my understanding of the physics involved. I guarantee, like every situation like this, Jack, you're one of the few guys who has flown an airplane that's well-equipped on many of these bands, and you can look at signal strength as you go up and down in altitude, and I bet you you've seen some of these effects. KF2GV, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hey, KF2GV returning. I just was wondering if it really matters. I didn't notice any difference whether I was at 5,000, 10,000, or 20,000 on 20 meters. I'm not talking about direct line of sight, because of course I can work everybody on any band direct line of sight. So once we got outside of that, there would be a whole different deal. And we can pick frequencies on the aircraft end of it. Was 5, 5, 5, 9, or 8. They seem to like to use that frequency when you go overseas. That when you hear them coming across. In fact, I worked when the SST was flying. I was able to work the SST at 60,000 feet on that frequency on 5, 5, 9, or 8. I remember working them, and when I was down there, unrelated to the radio, aside from working them, was the fact when I asked them what kind of a headwind or tailwind he had, it was only 10 knots at flight level 600, which is 60,000 feet. But again, my own situation, flying my own plane, I didn't notice any difference with the altitude.
When you said you were talking to them on 55598, where is the decimal place on that one, Jack?
55598.0. It's below 40 meters. Is that right? 40 meters is 7.2. So, yeah, it's okay. So it's five, I said it wrong now. 5.598. 5.598. Sorry about that. Yeah, it's just below 40 meters.
That sounds like fun. I've got a report that was done by the SR-71 sled flyers, as they call themselves, the Habu crew. In other words, the guys that flew the Blackbird, and I think they were flying over Los Angeles airspace one time, and they asked for clearance to 600, and the snotty guy at the tower said, how the hell are you going to get up to 600? To which he said, hey, this is an SR-71. I have to come down to 600. Over to you, Jack.
Yeah, above 600, you're out of controlled airspace. From flight level 180 to flight level 600 is the positive control zone, or class alpha airspace. Above 60,000 feet, it's basically uncontrolled airspace.
So as they were coming down to 600, they were asking for permission to descend to that altitude. They asked for permission to change altitude to 600, and the controller didn't realize it. At another time, if I could find the right report of various aircraft were signing in saying, hey, when you look at your scope, what is my apparent ground speed? At the time, they were flying Mach 3.2, so they came up with a huge number, which quieted everyone down real fast. A fun airplane. Can you imagine an airplane that flies continuously on afterburner? And one of these days, I'll have to give you some of my my puzzles about SR-71 aerodynamics. Okay, as I see it, Jack, when you've got really good band conditions, where a couple of different elevation angles with those fingers real close to the horizon, because you have 330 wavelengths above the ground, where they've got a couple of different ways the signal can get there. Except for a little bit of QSB, your buddy's going to see that you're talking to over the horizon. I think there, on many days, there's not going to be an apparent huge difference as you change altitude. But there are going to be some days when only a few of those fingers are making the path, because it's a real difficult path, real long DX. And let me drop. And by the way, when you drop this, you got to wait for the beep, because we are coupled together with more than one repeater in a kind of a funny way here. There are going to be days when because it's a very difficult path and only one or two of those elevation lobes are getting there, there's going to be some favored altitude for that particular condition that day. But where you've got that kind of altitude, you're certainly clearing the terrain, and got an awful nice horizon. I could calculate it, but your line of sight at 20,000 feet is some really crazy number, like, what is it, like 200 miles or something like that, Jack, go ahead.
Well, is the radial horizon and is the actual horizon. I believe at flight level 250, the horizon is about 220 nautical miles out. And the only reason I happen to know that is because historically when I work back into my repeater, when I start hitting 225 or 220, I can get back very reliable as long as, you know, assuming there's no ducting. I mean, I've had ducting where I've taken the airplane down to Florida on UHF and was able to work my repeater system from 25,000 feet down to about 6,000 feet, but that was an oddball situation. But typically, at flight level 650, 220 knots out is reliable. I have worked it up to about 270 on the radial horizon.
Very nice. And that's a 1,200 megacycle repeater you're going into, Jack, go ahead.
No, it's a 70 centimeter repeater. And the one that's up on 1.2 gig, I found there was tremendous amount of picket fencing at about 160 nautical miles out. A lot more
Either you got a low battery, Jack, or I heard an awful lot of wind going past your microphone on that last transmission. Go ahead.
I hear it coming out of you also.
Okay, I'm listening to what's coming out of the repeater, and there is no wind noise. So I think your battery is giving you a little bit of grief on that one. Okay, as you do these further experiments, Jack, at altitude, various altitudes, with various kinds of antennas on various bands, come back time to time and let us know what you've discovered, because not many of us have got the resources to do that. We dream about having our antenna 25,000 feet up, but very few of us have ever done that. I'm real happy to get my antennas 100 feet above the ground. I think I've really done something. Okay, of all the guys that signed in tonight, have we skipped over anybody? And let's make sure that I have it. Give me your call letters and name right now. KQLIW on the deck net.
Okay,
Eric recognized. Anyone else?
Yeah, I think there was somebody, W2WW, who checked in earlier.
You're right. And why in the world didn't I pick him up? He's on my list. Let's pick him up right now. WW2W, go right ahead with your question or comment. I hope you're still there. KQLIW in the tech net. Okay. Why in the world can I see him on my list? I remember writing him down, because my list is a little bit too sloppy here tonight. And I don't have to drive. Gordon, W2TTT, sometimes he runs his TechNet from his automobile as he's driving home from a scout meeting. My goodness. I've heard of a divided attention. You know, there are people worried about the fact you're not completely paying attention to what's going on the road if you're on a cell phone while you're driving. Can you imagine running a tech net and keeping track of all everybody's call letters and names and what questions they're asking and what order they ask them in while you're driving an automobile, and you've got children in the car with you because you're bringing them home from the scout meeting and they're talking to you? That's what I call real serious multitasking. Alrighty. One more call. Have we left out anyone who had a question or a comment? Give me your call letters right now. Oh yeah, Eric. Go ahead, Eric. KE2EJ.
No, I have the answer to the other gentleman's question. He tuned into WLNY, which is a 100-watt transmitter, no high stability oscillator for frequency. That's why the frequency is so different. It's only a temporary transmitter, and what I meant by out of core is that it's above channel 56 where all the TV stations end. It's actually channel 57. Actually, out of core is really 54 and up. Is it 54? Yeah, I think it's 54 and up. I'm not absolutely sure that it's 54, but it's somewhere around there. And I have a question. The gentleman who's doing all the experiments flying, what kind of an aircraft does he have that operates at 25,000 feet? That's a good one. K2RIW, K2EJ.
I said it just to our listening. This is KF2GV. It's a P Baron, a PE-58 / C. It's a P Baron. And it will go to flight level 250. In fact, it'll go higher. I got it up to 29,000.
Yeah, see, what's going on here, Jack, is that you called it a P-Baron. Those words roll off the lips real fast. One pilot talking to another, he knows exactly what that is. Among these radio people, they didn't even hear that word. They've never heard it before. Eric, you got it.
Yeah, I have. And when I was 17, I used to be a member of the Civil Air Patrol, and I learned how to pipe a J-4 with a stick. I mean, you can put your feet through the wings. That's how much fun it was. But I can't afford that stuff anymore. But anyway, I don't remember who the other gentleman was that was, you know, checking out his frequency standards. But that particular frequency that he was dealing with is not standard to anything.
Yeah, that was Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y, who was doing the frequency checking. What does the word core, C-O-R-E, in this particular application stand for, Eric, if you know?
Yeah, it's just a word that they use, in core, out of core, you know. UHF used to go up to channel 83, then it stopped at channel 79, and now it stops at channel 50, whatever. 50 whatever and below is in core, and 50 and whatever above is out of core, which disappears next year, February 17th, 2009.
Hey, give us your best guess, Eric, as to what's going to happen. Will we have a certain percentage of our population gnashing teeth and feeling real bad on February 17th because the majority of analog over the air television is going to disappear, and they've been ignoring all of these warnings? Or is it going to be a little bit like Y2K, everybody was pulling their hair out, thinking that the world's going to come to an end, and when Y2K happened, it was nowhere near that bad? What's your guess as to what it's going to be like on February 18th, 2009? K2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Well, barring an act of Congress, which probably won't happen because of all the money that's been spent and the antennas that have been changed. First of all, not everybody's going to switch off on that date. Some people will do it a little earlier, some people are going to do it a little later, simply because there aren't enough people around to make all the changes at the broadcast station. Not every broadcast station has a technical staff that's going to do it, so the transmitter manufacturers have to come and do it. For example, like WNET is going to make the switch. They're going to convert one part of the transmitter in the middle of December, so on the day they can make the switch. And then sometime after that, when everything calms down, they'll come back and make the change to the other transmitter. So, and what has finally been happening, if you do actually watch TV, the broadcasters have finally gotten off their rear end and started telling people about it. So it may not be as bad as it might have seemed a couple of months ago, but it's still going to be bad.
Station.
Okay, station. Please give us your call letters and name. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Yeah, I just wanted to check if I'm still in the rotation.
Yes, you sure are. And we gave a call for you. Oh, I forgot about you, then I gave a call for you. Go right ahead, sir, with your question or comment.
Yeah, just a few comments before my question. You cracked me up with the local frequency story. That was good. When I first checked in, I was using a mag mount on my fire escape, but I changed it to my homebrew Super J-Pole, which is now with a little mast above the roof line. I'm transmitting about 45 watts. So is my signal good into the machine, Dick?
Fantastic. Please proceed. Don't do what I just do. Wait for the beep.
Okay. I'm in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, by the way. Name is Anthony. Also, perhaps any of you gentlemen could also give me information. Just curious, with this new digital TV that's coming out, are there present antennas that people may have on the roofs, are they still going to be good, usable? What is the band plan for all this stuff? I can't find it anywhere. And maybe you guys can fill me on that. Okay, my main question has to do with heat sinks regarding black body radiators. Let me drop it. We all intuitively understand that when we wear a white t-shirt as opposed to a black t-shirt on a sunny day, it's much more comfortable with a white t-shirt. It's just strange thinking that something warm would radiate out better with a black t-shirt as opposed to a white. Now, heat sinks, the cheap ones are simply aluminum, and they work, but for some reason not as efficiently as something that's anodized black, painted black, or some other dark color. Maybe you could tell me which one would radiate better, red, green, or blue, and why something white, or even worse, with a specular reflection finish, such as hot rodders like to put on their engine parts, why I've heard that they don't radiate that well. Now, I know that... Let me drop it again. We like to use fans on these heat sinks, some of which have fins to increase the surface area and to also improve on convection current, not to be confused with radiation. The two types of ways of getting rid of heat. But given the constant temperature on a heat sink, it would seem to me that a fan actually would not directly reduce radiating. It would just lower the temperature, which would in turn lower the radiating. But the radiation itself is not, given the constant temperature, is not affected by a fan blowing on something, it would seem to me. So perhaps, Dick, you could speculate on my insights here from what I gathered so far. Back to Net Control, WWW.
Yeah, very good set of questions, Anthony. And this is one of those situations where what you see is not what you get. Your eye operates from roughly 400 to roughly 700 nanometers in wavelength, which is a little bit less than one octave. So of all the possible, let me stop for a second, of all the possible optical frequencies, your eye is very narrow band from one point of view, less than an octave. It's like assuming the 80 meter handband is the only handband we got and all the other bands don't exist. That's essentially the way your eye works. You probably have already heard from the courses you've taken in physics that are given in high school and certainly in colleges that as you set the physical temperature of an object, what you're really doing is setting the average kinetic energy of the molecules of that object. So in the case of something solid, like a chunk of aluminum, those little molecules are bouncing in space. They're bouncing in place. They're moving in place. They're locked in place by a lattice, so to speak, but they jump around faster as you go to higher in temperatures. You take a chunk of metal, you heat it up to a medium temperature with your blowtorch, and it starts glowing red. You heat it up to a higher temperature, it starts glowing orange. Higher temperature, yellow. Higher temperature, white. Higher temperature, blue. So the peak of the radiation of an object is directly related to its temperature. But when you and I are running a silicon or a germanium transistor on a heat sink, rarely do we get above 150 degrees centigrade, which is, optically speaking, an extremely low frequency. In other words, the peak of that radiation is way far into the infrared, much longer wavelength, much lower frequency, so to speak. One of the things that I've done in my youth was I used to use a 29 filter with aero-infrared exochrome film or with black and white infrared film. and I'd run around the yard taking pictures of things. And I was amazed that when I took a picture of grass and trees, they were bright white on a black and white infrared photograph, and the aluminum furniture in my backyard looked black. The aluminum furniture, to my eye, was a shiny, silvery-looking thing. To an infrared camera, it looked black. On a sunny day, I walked over to the aluminum furniture. In the old days, you didn't have a handrest on it like you do today. You touched the aluminum furniture, and it would burn your hand if it was in the sun. What was going on, let me drop, is that the sun puts out a whole lot of frequencies, including infrared. The aluminum is very absorptive at infrared. Yes, it does a better job if it's blackened, but now, since you're running such a low temperature, optically speaking, for your heat sink, it is transmitting the majority of its energy that it radiates by far, far infrared, and therefore, how much of a black body is your aluminum heat sink at the far, far infrared is what counts. And you make a slight increase when you make it blackened, but it's not huge. On top of that, if you can put a fan on the heat sink, you really favor convection. The convection, if the fins of the heat sink are vertical and the air near them gets heated, the air gets lighter because it expands, it moves upwards, and brings in cold new air. That's convection. Put a fan on there, and you can drastically increase the amount of heat sinking that you get. So when it comes to a normal heat sink in normal sea level environment, how fast the air moves past the heat sink is 90% of all the cooling you're going to get. The radiation of the heat by way of radiation, T to the fourth, it's called radiation. In other words, the amount of power in watts per square inch of signal coming off of your heat sink is a function of its temperature to the fourth power. So you double the temperature in degrees Kelvin, absolute temperature scale, and you multiply to the fourth power, which is, I think, 16 to 1. Double the temperature of your heat sink, and you get 16 times more watts per square inch coming off that heat sink. But even though that's true, convection far outweighs, in most situations, radiation. But if you're doing a real good job of design and you want to get the last little bit of performance, blackening it with anodized is going to blacking the heat sink is going to do a better job. Now, the paints that you and I buy, what you care about is not what your eye sees. What does that infrared, far, far infrared wave see? So you have to buy paint that is known to be a black body at infrared. The possibility exists that if you bought a particular brand of black paint, it might not be black at infrared. So if it's radiation you're trying to measure and trying to maximize, you can see you've got to favor the right wavelength of doing it. What if it makes some sense, Tony? WW2W, Anthony, K2LIW in the tech mask.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. I was thinking that painting something will black an actual paint, even though it may be thin, it may act almost like an insulator, so that's probably along the lines of what you're saying. Also, various pigments and dyes, like you said, could be the interface itself, the last few layers of molecules probably has a lot to depend on whether something radiates well or not. All right, thanks. You've helped a lot. I just started reading this book also. I didn't get much about black body radiators yet, but I just started in, Death by a Black Hole by Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's the director of the Rose Planetarium. I was at a telescope party and I met the gentleman who brought his torch and speaks a lot about his radiating bodies and stuff like that. So that's what got me to thinking along these lines. And you answered my question, especially with the... I used to do a little infrared photography myself, but I never had the fortune of taking a picture of an aluminum black chair. Let me drop it. But, yeah, that would make sense. And, yeah, the pictures, like you say, the trees come out are almost radiating white, and some other things are dark, and I guess that's what... Whatever it's taking that looks dark would be a good radiator. All right, back to Nat. This is WFTW. Thank you.
Yeah, the aluminum furniture I had in my backyard had no handrails on it. It was inexpensive aluminum furniture. It was shiny aluminum furniture, but in the sun, on a July day, when it's sitting there at high noon, you go over and touch that, it would almost burn you. So it was a lot black body. It was a black body absorber at infrared, even though at optical frequencies it was a pretty shiny thing, a highly reflective thing, almost a mirror. In fact, you can aluminize a parabolic mirror for your telescope and get some very high reflection if the aluminum is smooth enough in the way it sputters onto the actual mirror surface itself. When you paint a heat sink, any reasonable amount of paint, that like lacquer that you put on there, my guess is when it thoroughly dries, the thickness of the lacquer paint is well under a thousandth of an inch. No matter how good the insulation properties of the paint is, when it's only a thousandth of an inch thick, the total amount of thermal gradient you're going to get across that thousandth of an inch is going to be, I think, only a couple of degrees Fahrenheit. So I wouldn't worry about the heat sinking suddenly dying because you put a coat of paint on it. Yeah, put 40 layers of lead-based paint, you know, the real thick oil-based stuff we used to use, that's a different situation. Now, one of the things that I've noticed is that when you look at grass on a sunny day where the sun is shining on, or maple trees, for instance, the leaves look blazing white, and the grass looks blazing white on black and white monochrome infrared film. I've got a guess as to what's going on there. And that is, Mother Nature did that design of that leaf very nicely. Well, by survival of the fittest, selection of the best of the fittest, you know. What I think happened is that the photosynthesis works best with near ultraviolet light. The ultraviolet light is really doing the chemical process of that leaf, I think, converting the materials it has to work with into a food. So it's favoring ultraviolet. If the leaf was simultaneously highly absorptive at infrared, which photosynthesis-wise is fairly useless to the leaf, then the leaf would be running hot. If the leaf was running hot, it would be boiling away its moisture, which is very valuable. So the design of the leaf is a real cute design, which is reflecting infrared so that it doesn't run hot, but absorbing ultraviolet to do the photosynthesis process. That's what I think is going on. Back to you, Anthony, for any further comments on all of that. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. It answered most of my question. The other quick question I had actually had probably has something to do or is connected with the other question the person was asking about regarding this 20-meter monoband or whatever you put up. I had a question about operating a beam or an antenna over sand. Let's say you're in the Sahara Desert, you put up a tower. My question has to do with the properties of sand. Is sand a little bit transparent, RF? I mean, wouldn't you need some moisture to some degree to have resistance in the infinite series parallel to be lossy? Or are those little chips of sand glass itself lossy unto itself? Back to net?
Yes, the conductivity of soil, radio-wise and DC-wise, is highly dependent on whether or not it's made out of sand or loam or clay and how wet it is. The moisture content is a big factor. Those individual grains of sand of a real desert are so small, so highly insulated little pieces of silicon, and also so dry that their wavelength is extremely small. The conductivity from grain to grain is extremely small. Sand is probably almost an ideal dielectric material and an extremely low conductivity material. If I sunk two ground rods into desert sand and I put my ohm meter between them, I think I measure a very large number of ohms. It's almost a non-conducting material. Therefore, radio-wise, it is almost transparent. The normal ground reflection you and I get on Long Island, I think over desert soil, would be a lot lower ground reflection coefficient. Therefore, this elevation angle jazz that we worry about with height of the antenna versus the main lobe takeoff angle, I think you have much less of that to worry about when you're working with desert sand. When the sand is less reflective, the peaks are not as high of your elevation lobe, but the valleys are not as deep. So you don't get the sharp knolls between the peaks of the elevation pattern when you set the antenna some number of wavelengths above the ground when you're above sand. Now, getting back to, you met Neil deGrasse Tyson, awful nice guy. He's got some beautiful PBS programs. Make sure you get a hold of, while it's still on the newsstand, I hope it still is, the April 2008 issue of Smithsonian Magazine. On the front cover, let me drop, is an article about the search for black holes in the center of our galaxy. Beautiful 4 or 5 page article, nicely illustrated, nicely described in the latest issue of Smithsonian, telling you the latest research on the black hole that's in the center of our galaxy. And I think that black hole is something like 3 million solar masses. It's a pretty big one. And there are bigger ones than that, by the way. So you're going to kick out of that particular article. I think it's time we go over to Mel. He's going to go over to his mailbag, and he's going to find out what kind of questions he's gotten this week. And we're probably falling a little bit behind on questions. And one of these days, I think we should also give a little bit of a brief discussion, you and I, Mel, on the subject of Rayleigh fading statistics. But and also, I've had a couple of requests for Bessel function descriptions for FM modulation. But both of those are slightly deep subjects. Let's go to something a little bit lighter, like your mailbag. K2KEY, K2LAW, and the Tech Man.
K22QAQ.
Okay, stand by a minute, Mel. Go ahead, Glenn.
I just had a quick question for Eric about high-definition TV receivers, if he's still listening. Maybe you can answer a question for me.
Let's find out if he's still there, Eric.
Go ahead.
You got it, Glenn.
Hi, thanks, Eric. Just a quick question. I have a HDTV receiver made by Motorola, it's a set-top box. It's roughly about 4 or 5 years old, and it seems to work pretty well overall, you know, receiving stations. And everything coming in is pretty decent, but I was wondering, have they made any improvements? I was barely listening at the beginning of the TechNet, and you were mentioning that there were later generations of boxes, especially for high definition. But the main complaint I have with mine is every time I first turn it on, I haven't heard anybody make this complaint, but it takes almost like, I don't know, 5-10 minutes before it locates all the channels and programs them in before actually I can play something. Have they made any improvements with this, and is there a reason to actually look for a more upgraded receiver?
All right, well, that's your question in a simple word. Yes, it's gotten a lot better. The amount of time it takes to search and acquire a PTV channel has improved with the improved equalizer. So, yeah, but once the receiver has searched, I mean, there's no reason to do it again. So, does your receiver search every time you turn it on?
What I find happens, I have the antenna on a rotator, and it seems that every time I change direction, because, like, if I'm pointing west towards the city, there's a certain number of stations, and then as I rotate the antenna around to, let's say, Connecticut, and I want to pick up those stations over there, or further south down to Jersey, I kind of have to recalibrate everything. So, understand what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. But if you know the actual operating channels, why don't you just, dial in the channel that you're actually heading for rather than let the receiver search, because once you put it in, it'll stay there.
Gotcha. So basically just program the channels in permanently and then just leave them there, and then this way they're fixed channels, and then once I go with the initial scans, I can just kind of, like, leave them in as programmed channels?
Yeah, for example, like if you're pointing towards New York and you let it scan, it'll pick up all the stations, like 2, which is 56, and Fox, which is 44, even though you're dialing in 2-1 or 5-1 or 4-1. When you're dialing in 4-1, you're really getting 28-1. And let's say you turn your antenna the other direction, and wanted to pick up WLIW, which is actually 22-1. You dial in 22-1, it'll show up as 21-1, and that gets loaded into memory. You don't have to do a scan every time. If you know what the actual operating frequencies are, just dial them in once and you'll be done with it.
Great information, Eric. Thanks. I have one other question for you. I mentioned this last week in the TechNet, is that when I was originally setting up antennas and I was making measurements and looking at the reception on the sub-channels, I noticed that there was a lot of distortion and bad movement of motion on those channels. And one of the things I had to do was change my cable that was coming down from the antenna. I was using regular 75 ohm old coax. I changed it to RG6U, and I noticed a very large improvement. It wasn't so much in signal intensity, but just actually the quality of the picture. The signal strengths were almost identical, but I noticed that the movements of the pictures were more fluid. I was wondering, does the digital broadcast that you're receiving off of the antenna get affected much by the digital sampling frequency and the type of coax that you're using? Is there any relation to that? It's something that I noticed, and it might have just been something else, but that's what I kind of like attributed it to.
Well, let me suggest to you now that you put an RG6, you can put a pad in, you'll get the old problem back. But you're dealing with the signal strength. The thing is, the signal meters don't actually indicate strength. They indicate error. How much error correction is going on. When there's no error correction, the bars go up to 100%. As it gets lower and lower, the equalizer is trying harder and harder. So when you get to a certain threshold point before you lose it, you don't get a continuous stream. That's where you see motion artifacts. With the digital picture, you don't. It's not like good quality and bad quality. It's like no picture, and there's a small area in between where you get bits of picture, and it's a small area in signal strength. So, you know, your change from going from 59 to say RG6, you actually have more signal level at the receiver, and that's why you don't see the motion artifacts.
Yeah, good point. I'm glad you brought that up as well, because there were actually two things that I actually did together that improved it, and I didn't see so much of the signal strength change. I saw basically most of the high-definition main channels, in other words, like a 4.1, the 0.1 being the high-definition channel, always seemed to be okay. The channels that I was having the most problem with were basically the sub-channels that runs in -2s, -3s, and -4s. Where I saw most of the problems that I was having. And by adding a amplifier at the antenna and running the RG6U. Thanks for the input there, Eric. Yeah, because that definitely answered quite a few questions. I think I will also search around for a little bit better HD receiver, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, let me just add one more thing to you. The sub-channels and the main channel, no such thing. Okay, it's all one channel. What's really going on is it's think of it as one RF carrier which has different streams in it. It's all one continuous stream, but if you take a snapshot in time, you'll find out that part of that stream is the picture of the high definition channel of 4.1, and another part of that stream is the audio of 4.1, and another part of that stream is actually 4.2, and another part of that stream is 4.3. Same thing with the audio, and also another part of that stream is the guides that you get. So, really, what you were dealing with is being just on the threshold and not really quite having enough signal for the receiver to get happy with. But if you go to a more modern receiver, you won't have any of the problems that you see with your current receiver.
Thanks again, Eric. That kind of answers a lot of these questions, because I was listening last week to another gentleman mentioning on the air that, you know, some of the performance that he had seen. And initially, there again, a lot of this might have been just due to the age of the receiver that I had. And because all the high-definition channels, they would come in crystal clear, like you said, and I would just see the large block noise. In other words, where if the antenna started turning away from the station and I started losing the signal, I would see large blocks, and the picture would start getting choppy in blocks, sections, and I'd see that distortion. And as I got closer in on the signal, all of a sudden those blocks would go away and it would tighten up nice and easy. But even still with that, I started noticing that the other sub-parts of the channel started giving me some trouble. And it was, even though the high-definition part, the 4.1, was looking great, it was that the other channel seemed to have issues. And by increasing the amplifier and the cable, seemed to have fixed that. But what the actual correlation is, probably like you said, it's really just because the receiver's older. Thanks again, Eric. And let me just hand it back over to Dick. Casey, too, if you like it.
All right, I'm just going to throw one more thing at you. Let me let it recycle. Okay, when you're looking at 4.1 on NBC, you're looking at about 16 megabits worth of picture. When you're looking at 4.2, which is their Weber plot, you're only looking at about a half a megabit picture. When you're looking at their 4.4, you're looking at about a meg and a half data that makes the picture. So the quality of the image is less. The motion artifacts are greater. But when you're talking about big blocks, you're really talking about the receiver just being on the threshold. So there's a difference in the sub-channels. If you look at, say, channel 21, which is 22 actually, we have three channels going there, but they're all 6 megabits apiece, and they look better than any of the analog pictures, and they look better than any of the non-high-def stuff out there on all the other channels.
Yeah, absolutely, Eric. I just wanted to make that comment, too, because when I did get my cable straightened out and got the amplifier on the antenna, I was pointed out that I did find that those other channels, the 2s and the 3s, were actually fairly decent quality, that they weren't worse than analog television. Let me just hand it back to you or Dick for additional comments on that one, because someone was making the comment that those other channels, the quality wasn't as good as analog, and I find, you know, that they're, at least on a widescreen TV, they still look pretty good.
The reason for that is everybody's main channel is where they put their emphasis, so that's got the highest bit rate. If you ever look at a DVD, and some of the DVD players will let you see what the bit rates are, you'll see that those are variable bit rates. They will burst up to 10 megabits. But the average picture on a DVD player is around 3.3 megabits. Well, the TV channel can only handle a total of 19.39 megabits. That's the maximum. And in that, you have to put picture, sound, maybe another picture, and its sound. You also have data that guide information. You also have the EAS, which is the emergency broadcast. And there may not be much room left. So you give the most bandwidth to the picture that you care the most about, which would be the HD picture. And you make the other channels suffer because you don't have the room to bring them up to 3 megabits. So they're running like the Weather Plus. There really isn't much motion there. It's mostly still pictures. You can get away with 1.5 or 3/4 of a megabit. On the 4.4, they give it a little more, so they look so bad. But there's where the differences are. If you look at WNET, they actually run their HD a bit lower than, say, CBS and NBC does. But the two additional channels there have a better quality image than the other stations, let's say. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does. Thanks again there, Eric. And there's a few questions that were kind of bugging me for a while there. And thanks for your input, KC2QIQ.
Everything in life is a trade-off. I got two questions for you, Eric. Number one, if I'm using a rooftop antenna, and I've got reasonable line of sight to Empire, and I get a 50 dB carrier to noise ratio signal, essentially snow-free, ghost-free, on most of my channels, and I don't change that antenna, and I now connect a high-def system to it, which, by the way, assume I'm getting the same kind of quality out of my UHF reception, particularly with the rotator. If I do not change the feed line or the antenna, and I had darn close to high-quality analog television to begin with, will my digital reception, in most cases, be about as good? That's question number one, Eric. Go ahead.
No, it won't be about as good. It'll either be perfect or it won't be there at all. It'll be perfect, actually. Use a modern receiver with the latest technology, you won't have an issue. You may find, well, you're far enough away that you won't see the difference between, say, channel 5 and channel 4. If you were a little closer in, you might actually have to find a spot on your antenna where they all come in. And it also depends upon multicast. But again, with the newer receivers, you won't have an issue whatsoever. Next question.
Yeah, related to that one, is there a condition by which I can get adequate reception probability with digital TV, and then if that particular channel happened to be analog, I would see any kind of residual on the screen, like ghosting or the signal-to-noise ratio of snow? Go ahead.
Run that by me again. I'm not sure I understood what you asked.
Yeah, I'm asking it backwards. In other words, if I'm watching digital television on Channel 4, and assuming they were really on
the old-fashioned Channel 4 analog frequency, but the transmitting of digital TV. And if by some magic, and I was getting good reception, and now by some magic they flipped over to analog television, and I'm using the exact same antenna system, is it likely that I might see some artifacts on the analog reception of a antenna system on that exact frequency that previously gave me more than adequate digital reception? Over to you, Eric.
Actually, you'll find it interesting. I've been doing a lot of digital television, DSing, and you can find stations where you can barely see the analog. And lo and behold, when you tune to the digital, it locks right in, and the actual threshold in which the TCV signal bar and multipath, which the new receivers take care of, actually you get more bang for the buck out of your power that's being transmitted. So if you had a noisy analog picture, with today's receivers, you'd get a really good loft with the digital picture. And again, remember with the digital stuff, either it's there or it's not. There's a very small band of threshold area where it gets wonky. You know, you'll probably, even with a poor analog signal, get a good digital picture. And because of that, the actual amount of power that's being transmitted on the digital is nowhere near what's been transmitted on the analog.
Okay, here's a hypothetical question. I've got a pretty good rooftop antenna, but it's got one flaw, and that is it's got an extremely sharp, narrow suck out, 2.5 megacycles above the video carrier. So it's got a sharp knockout at 2.5 megs. When I watch that signal analog, I would see some artifacts, but the picture would be tolerable. Would digital television tolerate that suck out?
All right, first question is, how deep is it? By the way, what you would see in the analog is if it was 3 megahertz above the picture carrier, you'd get a beautiful black and white picture and your color would be weak. So, you know, depending upon where the suck out is, starting from the carrier, which you could consider DC for all practical purposes in the video, and moving up becomes resolution or sharpness of the picture. If you only saw, let's say, the first 2 megahertz of that signal, you would have a black and white picture that was very soft looking, wouldn't have a lot of detail on it. But if you have, say, a suck out that was at 3.58, you'd get no color, but you'd have a nice sharp picture. If the suck out was only, say, 100 kilohertz wide, it'd have a very profound effect. Now, if it was only a suck out that was, say, 20 dB down, I would probably say that today's digital receivers might possibly ignore it, but it's going to have a hard time. If it was an older generation receiver, forget it. They ain't never going to get a picture.
Is there any forward error correcting built into the code where it can tolerate a certain amount of information that is missing because of a narrow but deep notch in the frequency domain? Thank you, Eric.
If it's a really deep notch, it's not going to make up bits that it doesn't know exist, you know? There's a certain amount that the error correction will do, but you still got to have... You know, if it was COFDM, I'd say, have a happy time. It wouldn't be a problem because you actually have duplicates of the information in there. With the HPSC, it can tolerate, say, a 5 or 10 dB difference without a problem. Any more than that, just some sense starts to become problematic because of group delay.
I was going to guess that one also, that the main problem would happen if I had the sharp notch at 20 dB down at 3.57 megs. Not only am I sucking out the non-existing suppressed chrominant subcarrier, but a filter with skirts that steep is creating some huge group delay distortion, which means that the phase accuracy of the chrominant signal is such that I think Johnny Carson's face would turn green, or Jay Leno's face would turn green. Before I turn it over to the person who just joined us, let me ask you this one. When it comes to real good seventh generation converters that you know about, LG, Zenith, and this SN6 dash Delta Tango Tango 90 or 900. No, there was the SM dash DXA dash 1. Those are converters to take digital television into an old-fashioned analog set to be used as a monitor. If I'm now buying a fresh, brand new digital television, which has its built-in digital tuner, how do I know what generation of front-end converter I'm getting? In other words, has Consumer Report done a survey on the available brand names and model numbers at this time? KE2EJ, K2RAW, and the TechNet.
Now, here's where you run into trouble. Manufacturers don't all of a sudden throw their stock away and say, oh, you know, we'll just put the new stuff out there. Chances are, if you buy a big set with a Zenith or an LG label logo on it, you still run the risk of getting a previous generation. You can imagine that the rush was to make converters. And they have been making liquid crystals and plasmas, and they got pretty good stock of that stuff. I wouldn't put any bets on it that you're getting seventh generation anything in the sets yet, that you're probably getting fifth generation stuff, which isn't bad.
Kind of amazing that the latest generation is the converter, which we're only using temporarily, most of us, until we finally decide to break down and buy the real set. So you get the latest hardware on the thing that you're buying that's temporary, and the thing you're likely to buy that's permanent, you might not be getting the latest hardware. That's not the best of all worlds, is it, Eric?
Not at this point. You figure by the end of the summer, the beginning of next year, then, you know, things will be caught up. And it will take a while for other manufacturers to catch up, too, because who developed it? LG. Zenith Lab. So, you know, it's licensed, and as you well know, anytime you make a chip, the time to get it into production takes anywhere from, you know, 6 months to 3 years.
Yeah, the last time you and I had a discussion on the latest and the greatest converters, we were hearing about fifth generation. Now you come back from the National Association of Broadcasters conference, and we're hearing about seventh generation. Somewhere in there, does somebody sneak in a sixth generation, Eric?
Well, it was like the difference between when I had a third generation equalizer, all of a sudden it became a fifth generation equalizer. It turns out that the fourth generation equalizer didn't work so well. And I suspect the same thing happened again.
That makes more sense. Person with question, go ahead.
I'd like to be added to the list of topics in the MK2MIT.
And K2MIT, your name is?
Jeffrey.
Okay, Jeff. Let me pass it over to Mel and ask him, because we fell a little bit behind on our mail last week. And Mel, it's your decision. Should we take a piece of mail first before we pick up Jeff, or should we go to Jeff? It is your choice. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
It's 11 o'clock at night, Dick, so... either we, you know, pick up somebody's mail. I've been trying to answer a lot of them, and they've tapered off quite a bit because, I guess, because we haven't been getting to, I got some comments. I'm not going to, you know, say any comments on here, but some of the comments were very critical that why we ask for mail and never spend more than, like, 10 minutes on or 15 minutes on, which we doing lately, I know, quite late. So it's your TechNet, sir, and what do you want to do about these emails, either that or I've been trying to answer some of them and all, but I think they get discouraged with us, think over.
Go to the mail, then.
Thank you, Jeff. And by the way, Mel, it is our TechNet. It is a TechNet of the people, by the people, for the people. Of the hams, by the hams, for the hams. Go ahead, Mel. K2KEY, K2RAW.
Yeah, I think we should just draw a line and start at 11 o'clock so that we can get in the emails, which seems to be a really important part of the TechNet because it's very popular. So So I think we're neglecting something that really seems to have a lot of interest. All right, let me take this one here. This has been repeated over and over again, this thing about radio. The problem with radio is that they're very confused. The numbers